This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 7:16. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Sharmila and Lynn. And now we're moving on to talk about a nuclear submarine partnership or deal that is a trilateral one between Australia, the UK and the US. And we look at how that's going to impact our region.
Yes, and also about how it's already kind of created some rifts, I think, in terms of the security powers or the bigger security powers. And this is coming because, Australia signed off on the snazzy sounding AUKUS, I think we're calling AUKUS. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that spelled out, it's basically everybody's involved. Australia, UK, US, it's all in the acronym. And they're going to develop nuclear powered submarines with cooperation from the UK and the US. And it's going to see all three countries exchanging technology and intelligence. And part of it also involves the US and the UK arming Australia with the means to develop nuclear powered attack submarines. And it also makes Australia the seventh nation in the world to operate these submarines. However, where there's been some drama, some back and forth, is that the signing of this deal means that Australia pulled out of a major contract with France in the process of it. And that was one that was signed by Australia in 2016 for France to build 12 conventional submarines. And that deal was worth 27 billion euros.
So you said drama.
It is really.
Because France's defence minister following this has actually cancelled a meeting with the UK defence minister. Now, UK Defence Minister Ben Wallace said that there had been no intention to upset France or to drive a wedge between them. But this is where we are. And if we bring that home in terms of what that means for us here in Malaysia, so far the Prime Minister's office has reported that our Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri, as well as his Australian counterpart, Scott Morrison, had renewed their commitments to ensure peace, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region. And our PM then also urged all countries to avoid provocation, as to essentially avoid an arms race in this region. He also emphasized the importance of mutual respect while respecting existing agreements. So it's a lot to unpack. It's also, I think, left a couple of questions open in terms of alliances and what this might mean for these countries as we move forward. That's what we're going to get into. But do share your thoughts with us. You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, to help us understand and unpack this, we are joined by Nick Muhammad Rashid Nick Zurin, who is a former researcher covering defence and national security issues at REFSA. Rashid, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Sharmila. Thank you, Nini. I just want to preface by saying that since I'm here and I did used to work at REFSA, my opinions that I share today do not reflect anyone's at REFSA. So just putting that disclaimer there.
Sure.
Thank you for inviting me to actually talk about this. It's one of the topics that has also been buzzing around in my own news feed. And I do have a few strong opinions about it. So I'm excited to share them with you today. So how do we want to go about doing this?
Well, we can start by you outlining what the AUKUS Alliance, what it means and how it came to be.
Right. Okay. So I think we need to sort of take a step back and also recognize that the discussion right now seems to be surrounding around one aspect of a much bigger thing. So AUKUS is the main thing in the discourse now is the nuclear attack submarine, or the SSNs, as we call it in defense circles. AUKUS is actually much more wide-ranging than that. It actually covers a few defense technologies, not just nuclear-powered submarines. And so just to give you a list of the things that President Biden has actually stated when he announced the deal, it covers artificial intelligence, cyber defense technology, quantum computing, underwater systems, of which the submarines are a part of, but there are other things that are being done underwater that, you know, pretty interesting, but also pretty scary if you get into the weeds of it. And I think this is probably one of the most concerning things is long-range strike capabilities. And when we talk about this, nobody has actually defined it specifically yet. And again, all of this is very preliminary, but when you talk about long-range strike capabilities, usually you're talking about ballistic and cruise missiles that have several thousands of kilometers of range, reaching well beyond intercontinental ranges. So the AUKUS deal is pretty huge, right? So it covers a lot of different things, and the submarines are only a part of that. And I think it's also important to have this distinction here that Australia is not planning to buy it off the shelf. Whether it's secondhand or buy a new design off the shelf, it is an intention to follow on from their previous submarine project with the French to build the industry domestically so that they can not only operate but sustain the nuclear attack submarines over its entire service life. So I think that's a very important distinction to make, because I think a lot of people miss that nuance, that this is going to take a long time to mature, right? Because right now what President Biden has only promised is an 18-month assessment and evaluation process to figure out what the easiest and maybe cheapest way to do it for Australia with the United States and the United Kingdom stuff. Right. So, and I think just to build on to that a little bit more, I don't think the submarines were the only element that sort of pushed Australia into this deal. Because if you look at the scope, again, it covers a wide range of defense technologies. I think it's sort of implicit, though I'm not intimately familiar with the details, because again, this was, so one of the most surprising things is such a big deal was negotiated in secret. A lot of people in Canberra are on record to have said that actually we didn't know that this was going to happen, right? So you kind of blindsided people even within Australia. The French were completely blindsided. I think a lot of French diplomats actually came out and said, you know, it wasn't a lie of omission. It was directly lying to us. You know, so everybody knew that there were problems with the French deal with the Australians for a long time. And so the French did ask the United States and the United Kingdom, how is this going to work out? And, you know, basically they told that we're not going to undercut you. So that was sort of the feeling that the French diplomats had when it was finally announced. So, but to get back to the point that I was making, again, I don't think it was just the subs that pushed Australia into it. I think it's also these other things, these other levels of cooperation, these other technologies that they're cooperating on. I think that sort of was a big selling point. And the subs just happened to be another plus point that pushed them into the yes column.
So that's what Australia gets. Can we talk about the UK and the US and, you know, what their deal is in this deal?
Right. So I think for the United States and the United Kingdom, I think part of their entire Indo-Pacific strategy is trying to get allies within the region to sort of be a part of their coalition, for better or for worse, in competition against China, right? And I think within ASEAN, it's not immediately clear that everybody is either for China or for United States, right? So I think, and I think this sort of gets into the statements that we see from Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri, Dato' Sri Shamini Hussein, even from Pakatan Harapan's own Jawatan Kuasa Keselamatan, which also actually released a statement. I think you get a lot of mixed reactions in ASEAN. So Malaysia and Indonesia pretty much have a similar position. We're anxious about what we see this development. Singapore and Philippines, so Teddy Loxin, the foreign minister of the Philippines, just came out with a statement actually today welcoming it and saying that, you know, this capability adds adds more weight to Australia in the region to counter China. Singapore was, they were a bit subtle about it, but not as overt as Teddy Loxin, definitely, but they were very subtle about welcoming it, definitely. Other Indo-Pacific, East Asian countries sort of in the loop. Japan is obviously welcoming of it because, again, Japan is a treaty ally of the United States, so that's not really surprising. I think for the US, the UK, and everyone sort of on that side of the aisle, it's actually a further logical step in evolving relations with Australia. And more importantly, within the Indo-Pacific, having another cemented ally. So I think one of the things that's great about this, at least in theory for the United States, is if you open up this facility, which is supposed to be built in Adelaide, you can now, if you're using US and UK reactor tech to begin with, if this facility is open in Australia, then US and UK subs going through the Pacific, and in this part of the Pacific at least, will have another place to sort of stop over and do some logistical work as required. That is sort of one of the theoretical benefits, at least from an operational standpoint. Of course, again, it's still preliminary. Nothing has been built yet, so we don't know for sure what design they're eventually going to go for and how the technology will be transferred. But I can see that being as one of, you know, a compelling argument for US Indo-PACOM.
How would this deal affect security and relations in the Indo-Pacific region, especially considering China's influence?
Right. So I think So one of the things that has been mentioned, so one of the official position of Malaysia and Indonesia seems to point to this idea of an arms race. In fact, one of the things that Ismail Sabri, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri has said is he's worried about, or at least he says on behalf of Malaysia that we're worried about a nuclear arms race. So I think it's important to sort of unpack that statement because, I think Ismail Sabri's statement by saying that it's a nuclear arms race is sort of a misunderstanding or misperception because, again, these are nuclear-powered, not nuclear-armed attacks. So that's a very important distinction to make. So what that means is instead of having a typical conventional diesel-electric engine to propel the vessel, you have an actual nuclear reactor. All right. And that's a very important distinction to make. So in that sense, I don't think it's part of the nuclear arms race discussion. Now, that being said, there is a very real arms race in terms of nuclear weapons between the major nuclear powers. So the Russians, the Chinese, the United States are now entering this very, very dangerous world of developing hypersonic glide vehicles, which in the world of, so if you're intimately familiar with the world of deterrence, it has a lot of implications for how nations in the deterrence stability game are able to perceive and therefore react to nuclear attacks. So to summarize, there is an issue with it being, there is an issue of nuclear arms race between nuclear armed countries, but this is not the specific instance that I would put under that column. Now, as far as an argument for regular arms races is concerned, I think that's just a natural issue of the security dilemma, right? So in international relations, the idea of the security dilemma is countries arm themselves to feel secure, but by doing so, make other countries insecure. So it kind of has to be said here, I feel, that it takes two countries at least to make an arms race. So if we point to Australia and say that, oh, you know, this development is going to provoke an arms race, you have to sort of take a step back and look at what China is doing and see how many nuclear subs that they have and that they've been developing and how much more they will have in the next 20, 30, 40 years. And then you sort of have to see that and that together and contextualize it, right? So is there an arms race? Yeah, sure, but you can't sort of point to one and then ignore the other. So which I think is one of my problems with how we have reacted to the situation. Now, I'm not saying an arms race is great. It's not. It's actually going, in all likelihood, it will increase the likelihood of conflict. But at the same time, it's important to contextualize that and understand that there's some underlying dynamics in that sense. The other thing I wanted to say very quickly about this is I think China and Australia have sort of had a downturn in relations for the last 3, 4, 5 years. So yes, it was a surprise to see this deal come out, but it is a logical step in that evolutionary path, right? You know, like China has banned imports of coal from Australia. So, I mean, so they're already engaging in a tit for tat when it comes to trade. So this doesn't, I mean, it's surprising because it was secret, but it's not surprising in the sense of, well, I mean, like if I were in Australia's shoes, this is exactly what I would do. That's my reaction to that.
Rashid, thanks for speaking with us today. That was Nick Mohammad Rashid Nick Zurin, former researcher of defense and national security issues at REFSA, weighing in on this drama that's happening in the Indo-Pacific region between Australia, the UK, US, and peripherally France. Keep sending your thoughts our way. You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.